What if everything you believed about success and happiness was fundamentally flawed? Raj Raghunathan's groundbreaking work challenges the core assumptions that drive many high achievers. Once a carefree, lighthearted child who could sleep soundly before exams while peers pulled all-nighters, Raghunathan transformed into a successful but stressed academic until he realized something was missing. His course on happiness at Macomb School of Business defied skeptics by becoming wildly popular, eventually reaching over 100,000 online students as Coursera's top-rated MOOC of 2015. The book's appeal extends far beyond academia. Oprah Winfrey featured its concepts on her Super Soul Sunday program, and tech executives from Google to Facebook have embraced its counterintuitive wisdom. What makes this work so compelling is its perfect fusion of rigorous science and practical wisdom, offering a genuine path to both happiness and success that doesn't require sacrificing one for the other. Why do we consistently make choices that undermine our happiness? This question lies at the heart of what Raghunathan calls the fundamental happiness paradox. When asked what they would wish for from an all-powerful genie, most people request money, success, and relationships, but rarely happiness itself, despite rating happiness as their most important life goal when directly asked. This disconnect manifests in everyday decisions, choosing value over enjoyment at a salad bar, sacrificing passion for prestige in career choices, or insisting on being right instead of kind in relationships. To test this paradox in real-world settings, Raghunathan conducted revealing experiments with business students. When asked which job would make them happier, a high-paying but stressful position, or a lower-paying but intrinsically rewarding one, 78% chose the intrinsically rewarding job. Yet, under simulated interview pressure, more than half selected the higher-paying option instead. Similarly, as MBA students approached actual job interviews, their preferences shifted dramatically from intrinsically motivating positions toward extrinsically rewarding ones. This paradox affects roughly 15 to 20% of our decisions in any given context, but since we make thousands of choices daily, the cumulative impact on our happiness is substantial. The fundamental question remains, why do we devalue happiness when we claim it's our most important goal? Three main reasons emerge. First, happiness seems too abstract compared to concrete goals like money or status. We struggle to grasp what isn't easily defined. Second, we harbor negative beliefs about happiness, fearing it breeds laziness or selfishness, though research proves the opposite. Happy employees perform better, happy CEOs achieve better returns, and happy people volunteer more and donate more to charity. Third, we simply forget about happiness as an end goal, falling prey to media maximization, pursuing means, like money, while forgetting why we wanted them in the first place. The solution to devaluing happiness isn't directly chasing it. That backfires spectacularly. When we actively pursue happiness by constantly comparing how we feel with how we want to feel, we become unhappy about being unhappy. Like sleep, happiness comes when we create the right conditions but don't obsessively monitor it. This paradox is similar to trying to force creativity or relaxation. The harder we try, the more elusive it becomes. Instead, Raghunathan recommends prioritizing happiness through two key steps. First, define what happiness means to you personally. While happiness encompasses emotions like love/connection, joy, and authentic pride, two definitions deserve special attention. Harmony, the feeling of not wanting to be elsewhere doing something else, where you can experience negative emotions yet still be happy if they don't feel unwanted. And abundance, the feeling of having more than enough of everything you could want, where life seems like a cozy mess and challenges make life interesting rather than threatening. For example, harmony might mean feeling content while stuck in traffic because you're listening to a fascinating podcast, or experiencing grief at a funeral while appreciating the beauty of shared memories. Second, create a portfolio of reliable happiness triggers by recalling previous occasions when you felt happy according to your definition and identifying what caused those feelings. This creates a concrete collection of happiness determinants you can intentionally incorporate into your life. These might include specific activities like morning walks in nature, relationships, regular coffee dates with close friends, achievements, completing challenging projects, or environments, spending time by the ocean. The key is identifying patterns in your past experiences of genuine happiness rather than society's prescribed sources of joy. This two-step process makes happiness concrete and personally meaningful, helping overcome vague understandings and negative beliefs. By defining happiness as authentic pride, for instance, you counter the belief that happiness makes you lazy, since achievement requires effort. Similarly, equating happiness with harmony or abundance challenges the notion that happiness is fleeting. Both steps combat medium maximization by highlighting which decisions actually enhance your well-being. For instance, someone might realize their happiness stems more from creative expression than material acquisitions, or from deep conversations rather than social media interactions. The approach also acknowledges that happiness can coexist with difficulty. It's not about eliminating negative experiences, but rather about creating a framework where both positive and negative experiences contribute to a meaningful life. This might mean finding satisfaction in the challenge of learning a new skill, or appreciating the growth that comes from navigating life's obstacles. Our second deadly happiness sin is the compulsive pursuit of superiority over others. From childhood, we receive messages that we should strive to be the best in whatever we do. This conditioning creates a deep-seated need to outperform others, visible in everything from aging entertainers desperately clinging to fame to carefully curated social media personas showing only our achievements and most flattering images. We pursue superiority for several reasons. Evolutionary advantages, historically being stronger or wealthier enhanced survival, childhood conditioning, learning that love depends on outperforming peers, measuring progress toward mastery, and gaining autonomy. Higher status individuals face fewer social constraints. Being superior does temporarily boost happiness. The famous Whitehall studies reveal that despite receiving identical medical attention, higher status government employees enjoy better health, lower mortality rates, and longer lifespans than lower status colleagues. This occurs because higher status provides two crucial psychological benefits: better self-esteem and greater autonomy. Here lies the paradox. While being superior enhances happiness, pursuing superiority diminishes it. The problem begins with measurement. How do we determine who's best in subjective domains? Since objective yardsticks are scarce, we resort to proxy measures like wealth, power, and fame. These extrinsic metrics push us toward materialism, which undermines happiness through rapid adaptation. The psychological boost from higher earnings wears off quickly. Unrealistic expectations about what possessions will bring, and reduced compassion that causes others to cooperate less with us. Beyond materialism, tethering self-worth to outperforming others creates vulnerability to depression through obsessive concern about potential failure. The need for superiority also damages relationships. Takers, as Adam Grant calls them, are less liked and people are less willing to cooperate with them. Perhaps most critically, the habit of comparing oneself with others, a natural consequence of superiority seeking, consistently lowers happiness levels. The antidote to chasing superiority is pursuing flow, those magical moments when you become so engrossed in an activity that external distractions fade away and time disappears. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi documented this phenomenon through an innovative research method. Participants carried beepers programmed to sound at random times, prompting them to record both what they were doing and how they felt. Flow experiences share several distinctive characteristics. Time perception becomes paradoxical, simultaneously slowing down and speeding up. Self-consciousness disappears, and you become intensely focused on the immediate task. Flow occurs in the sweet spot between anxiety and boredom, when your skills are matched by the challenge, or ideally, when the challenge is slightly beyond your current abilities. unlike superiority seeking, flow enhances happiness in multiple ways. First, flow experiences are inherently enjoyable in the moment. Second, flow leads to mastery. Since flow occurs when you're challenged to improve, stringing together enough flow experiences inevitably develops your skills. Finally, flow creates positive social ripples. People are inspired by seeing others in flow, whether it's a band rocking out or a passionate professor lecturing. Though flow drives achievement, we mistakenly attribute our successes to our desire for superiority. Ironically, focusing on worldly success often hinders achievement. While the need for superiority might initially motivate us, it becomes counterproductive once we begin a task. Our mental processing capacity is limited. The more we focus on wealth, fame, or power, the less capacity we have for the task itself. To incorporate more flow into your life, identify your talents and nurture them in your current job while finding ways to meet community needs. Add more activities you enjoy at work, as enjoyable activities are likely to induce flow. If your current job doesn't allow you to exercise your strengths, consider a gradual transition rather than an abrupt change. Maintain your current job while exploring more meaningful alternatives through volunteering or part-time work in your area of interest. Our fundamental need for emotional connection manifests in surprising ways. Research shows that perceived agreement with others is a stronger driver of enjoyment than the actual quality of experiences. When others agree with us, we feel optimistic about connecting with them, which makes us feel good. The most compelling evidence for our need for connection comes from research showing that perceived loneliness is perhaps the single biggest determinant of numerous psychological and physiological illnesses. Multiple studies confirm that social connection is essential for happiness. Every person in the top 10% happiest group had at least one intimate relationship. A 70-year Harvard study showed relationship strength was the only characteristic distinguishing the happiest 10% from others. Another study found that of 25 activity categories, the two happiest involved human connection, intimate relations, and socializing. Conversely, social isolation activates the same brain regions as physical pain. While the need for love and connection is critical for happiness, pursuing it desperately becomes another deadly happiness sin. A healthy desire for connection manifests as secure attachment, balancing the desire for intimacy without desperation. Unhealthy desires manifest as either neediness, desperate for intimacy, or avoidance, threatened by intimacy. Neediness reduces happiness because it's unattractive to others. People devalue what's too easily available. This triggers loneliness as people avoid the needy, creating a vicious cycle of increased desperation. Avoidance, despite appearing opposite, also reduces happiness by spoiling relationship quality. Though avoidants present as strong and independent, they secretly desire connection but want others to initiate it, leading to isolation when this doesn't happen. Attachment styles can be altered despite childhood conditioning. Simple exposure to words like love or recalling nurturing childhood memories can temporarily boost security feelings. For lasting change, practice expressing gratitude to enrich your social life by helping find, remind, and bind relationships, identifying potential friends, appreciating their strengths, and strengthening bonds. Also practice self-compassion by recognizing that everyone experiences hardships, creating connection through common humanity. Research consistently shows that spending money on others makes people happier than spending it on themselves, contrary to what most people predict. A University of British Columbia study found students given money and told to spend it on others reported significantly greater happiness than those told to spend it on themselves. This pattern holds true globally. A survey across 136 countries found that in 90% of them, those who donated to charity reported higher life satisfaction, equivalent to doubling household income. The consistent positive effects of altruism on happiness suggest humans have an innate need to love and give. Research with toddlers demonstrates this innate tendency. A study with nearly 2-year-olds found they were happiest when sharing their own treats with a puppet, happier still than when giving the experimenters treats or receiving treats themselves. This costly giving, producing the greatest happiness, suggests children have a natural inclination toward kindness. Being generous makes us happier for several powerful reasons. It shifts focus from our problems to others' needs, generates reciprocity through gratitude, improves physical health, and enhances our self-image as kind and abundant. In one remarkable study, 5 women with multiple sclerosis who volunteered as peer supporters experienced benefits 7 times greater than the patients they helped. Contrary to the belief that success requires ruthlessness, evidence shows that generosity leads to greater professional achievement. Adam Grant's research demonstrates that givers often rise to the top in business settings. Economist Arthur Brooks found that while earning more increases charitable giving by 14%, the reverse effect is even stronger. For every dollar donated, income increased by a remarkable 375%. Being generous doesn't guarantee happiness or success. There's a crucial distinction between selfless givers who burn out and otherish givers who thrive. Both are well-intentioned, but otherish givers follow 3 essential rules. 1. Contain the cost of giving by maximizing efficiency. 2. Use value expansion strategies to manage emotional resources. And 3. Witness the impact of their giving, which research shows significantly boosts happiness. Our deep-seated desire for control serves important purposes. It fosters self-efficacy, the belief we can shape outcomes to our liking, and provides personal autonomy. Research dramatically demonstrates these benefits. In one study at an old age home, residents given simple choices about plants and movies experienced 1/2 the mortality rate of those denied such choices. However, control seeking has a tipping point. While those with higher control needs generally set loftier goals and achieve more, becoming obsessive about control, constantly trying to make things better or fixating on outcomes, actually diminishes happiness. Being overly controlling of others diminishes happiness for 3 key reasons. First, it triggers psychological reactance, people's natural resistance to having their autonomy restricted. Second, it creates power stress, the frustration and anger that emerge when others don't behave as you want. Third, controlling behavior drives away diverse perspectives, surrounding you with only yay-sayers, which ultimately damages your decision-making quality. Being overly controlling of outcomes occurs when the desire to achieve outcomes controls you, rather than you being in control of the desire. This obsessive passion diminishes happiness because life's inherent uncertainty guarantees disappointment for control seekers. Studies show they experience higher blood pressure, worse mood in crowded rooms, and greater dissatisfaction when things don't go as planned. Since being overly controlling reduces happiness, learning to control one's control-seeking tendencies becomes essential. One approach is learning to appreciate rather than avoid uncertainty. Interestingly, studies show we're happier with uncertainty in positive situations, like receiving a free dollar without knowing why, than with certainty, despite predicting the opposite. The antidote to external control seeking is developing internal control, the ability to regulate your thoughts and feelings regardless of external circumstances. Taking personal responsibility means never blaming others or circumstances for your feelings. This doesn't mean becoming delusional or letting people take advantage of you. You can simultaneously refuse to blame others for your feelings while still holding them accountable for consequences of their actions. 4 powerful emotion regulation tactics can help you gain internal control. Situation selection, avoiding triggering situations. Emotion labeling, acknowledging feelings without ruminating. Attention deployment, redirecting focus from negative triggers. And cognitive reappraisal, reinterpreting negative situations. Importantly, suppressing emotions doesn't work. It keeps brain activation patterns unchanged and consumes mental resources. What makes some countries happier than others? While economic prosperity and political stability matter, trust is an even more crucial determinant of national happiness. Research shows that countries where citizens believe most people can be trusted report significantly higher happiness levels. In Denmark and Norway, among the world's happiest countries, nearly 65% of citizens trust others, while in unhappier countries like Greece and Russia, fewer than 10% do. When we trust others, they typically reciprocate with trustworthy behavior. In trust game studies, participants given $10 could send it to an anonymous partner where it would be quadrupled to $40. The partner could then either keep everything or share half. Despite cynical predictions, over 95% of recipients share the money when trusted. This happens because being trusted releases oxytocin, the trust molecule, that promotes reciprocity. Despite understanding the benefits of mutual trust, most of us hesitate to take the first trusting step. This reluctance stems from our evolutionary hardwiring to focus on potential negatives for survival. We are programmed to distrust by default, even though most people prove trustworthy when given the chance. People consistently demonstrate a cynical bias in how they interpret others' behaviors. When presented with scenarios involving both positive and negative actions, people tend to attribute negative behaviors to internal causes. They're rude or they're dishonest, while attributing positive behaviors to external circumstances. This default cynicism prevents us from reaping the happiness benefits that come with trusting others. To practice smart trust, Raghunathan recommends four components. First, remind yourself that people are more trustworthy than you give them credit for. Second, remember all benefits of proactive trust, viewing it as an investment rather than a risk. Third, minimize pain from betrayals while maximizing positivity from validated trust. Fourth, find ways to elicit trustworthy behavior from others, recognizing that most people's trustworthiness isn't fixed but contextual. When trust is violated, three strategies can minimize the pain. Perspective taking, recognizing that for the materially comfortable, the consequences of being cheated are often insignificant. Holding violators accountable to understand their motivations, and practicing forgiveness. Studies confirm forgiveness benefits the forgiver, both mentally and physically, reducing anxiety and increasing self-esteem. Mind addiction refers to our tendency to underestimate the importance of gut instincts and feelings while overvaluing rational deliberation. This stems from two interrelated beliefs: that thoughtful deliberation is the most reliable problem-solving approach, and that feelings detract from rather than enhance our judgments. In one revealing study, 68% of participants chose a larger but disgusting bug-shaped chocolate over a smaller, appealing one, simply to appear rational, despite not enjoying it afterward. Mind addiction directly leads to devaluing happiness, as demonstrated in studies where participants make choices that prioritize appearing rational over maximizing enjoyment. Sometimes, feelings and gut instincts serve us better than thoughtful deliberation in making decisions that will truly make us happy. Our gut instincts aren't random, but repositories of useful evolutionary information. Harvard studies showed students could accurately predict professors' end-of-semester ratings after watching just 3 seconds silent video clips. Similarly, undergraduates correctly predicted car salesmen's success just from photographs. Mind addiction creates a serious happiness barrier through lack of self-awareness. Without self-awareness, we sabotage our own happiness through self-deception, like pretending we're not status-conscious when we are, or believing we have secure attachment when we're actually needy. Mindfulness is the antidote to mind addiction. It's like being a fly on the wall of your own mind, observing your internal experiences with interest and curiosity, but without clinging to them. The gate model illustrates how thoughts typically trigger a web of consequences. When a thought appears, "I'm late picking up my son," it typically triggers another thought, "I always slip up." Then emotions, shame, actions, rushing to the car, and goals, appeasing your son with a snack. Mindfulness offers a way to break these webs by stepping outside the gate of your mind. While mindfulness involves observing thoughts as if happening to someone else, the paradoxical outcome is greater intimacy with what you're observing. Bare attention, observing without commenting, judging, or ruminating, differs from mind attention, filtering observations through mental commentary. When practicing bare attention, the racing pace of the mind slows, allowing closer connection with what you're observing. Though mindfulness involves intimate contact with our experiences, it paradoxically diminishes negative feelings rather than intensifying them. Like clouds that appear solid from a distance but are insubstantial when entered, negative emotions seem overwhelming when viewed from the mind's perspective but reduced to mere sensations when observed directly. Remarkably, while mindfulness diminishes negative feelings, it intensifies positive ones. Research involving over 16,000 participants revealed that people are happier when fully present rather than mind-wandering, regardless of whether the activity is pleasant or unpleasant. A bird's-eye view of happiness reveals that it requires three fundamental elements once basic necessities are met. First, mastery, feeling competent at something valuable, whether dancing, teaching, or managing our own thoughts. Second, belonging, experiencing meaningful connection with at least one other person. Third, autonomy, feeling we author our own judgments and decisions rather than being controlled by others. Together, these three needs form an MBA, mastery, belonging, and autonomy, the essential ingredients for happiness. While mastery, belonging, and autonomy are necessary for happiness, they're not sufficient. How we pursue them matters tremendously. Each need has two possible routes, a scarcity route and an abundance route. For mastery, we can pursue superiority, scarcity, or flow, abundance. For belonging, we can be desperate for love, scarcity, or nurture our need to love and give, abundance. For autonomy, we can seek external control, scarcity, or internal control, abundance. The scarcity routes all stem from zero-sum thinking, feeling incomplete, or fearing undesirable outcomes. The abundance routes emerge when we feel adequately taken care of, confident, and capable. The happiness exercises aim to shift us from scarcity orientation toward abundance orientation. The two approaches to MBA framework highlights how abundance orientation creates a win-win-win solution by promoting altruism, creativity, and mature interactions. The happiness recipe isn't just a win-win-win solution, but a win-win-win-win solution, boosting personal happiness, success, altruism, and meaningful productivity at the societal level. To maintain improved happiness levels, three key strategies are essential. First, respond to daily questions from a peer coach who helps track progress in replacing happiness sins with habits. Second, carefully choose your context, both the people and environments you expose yourself to. Surround yourself with abundance-minded individuals rather than scarcity-minded ones. Spend time in nature and join communities of happiness seekers. Third, maintain open-mindedness by avoiding rigid self-identities that limit growth. Implementing these strategies makes leading a happier life the truly smart choice. Because if you aren't happy, how smart are you really?